This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Every once in a while, very public people are dragged through the mud for things they did or didn't do. When this happens in the political arena, the fallout can be embarrassing, long, and far-reaching. Modern politics seemed to be a breeding ground for scandal, something that probably started with Watergate, but which came to a zenith in the 90s with the Whitewater scandal. You'll recall Whitewater was a real estate investment that Hillary Clinton's Arkansas law firm, the Rose Law Firm, was involved with. And that firm's involvement became a target of Special Prosecutor Kenneth Starr, who seemed, at least for a while, to be going after all things Clinton. Webb Hubble found himself caught up in that. A member of the Rose Law Firm, who went on to be President Clinton's Associate Attorney General, he eventually pled guilty to federal wire and tax fraud charges and spent, I think, 18 months in prison. Then he effectively disappeared from the public eye. Do you ever wonder what happens after something like that overturns your life? Well, we're going to find out the long of it in the course of this hour, because the short of it is the fact that Webb Hubble has moved to Charlotte and has now written his first novel called When Men Betray. It's set in a fictionalized Little Rock, and Webb Hubble joins us for the hour. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Nice to have you here. One of the pull quotes on the dust jacket of your book says that this mystery thriller quickly buries readers deep in the twisted tunnels of Arkansas's political and criminal underbelly. You were once the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court of Arkansas and the mayor of Little Rock. Does Arkansas really have a twisted political underbelly?
Well, the book is fiction, but I think there's a dark side to every place. And we try to, in the book, talk about that dark side.
Now, I was at another station prior to Bill Clinton becoming the president. He had just been, I think, I'm not even sure he had been nominated to be the Democratic candidate for president. I think he was just talking about running when all these stories started coming out of Arkansas about Bill Clinton and his sordid life. And it had nothing to do necessarily with the scandals, the sex scandals, but it had to do with things like drug dealing and murder and things like that. And some of these were coming from political sources. Some of them were coming from journalistic sources. Now, there's a newspaper in Arkansas that is rabidly anti-Clinton.
Yes, there is.
I forgot which one it is. You probably know.
I know it pretty well.
Okay. But it was at a stage where I thought, we don't even know who this man is, and they are actively putting out all this stuff that could be true, probably isn't. It just sounds like they're digging dirt like there's no tomorrow. Is that the twisted political underbelly exposing itself?
No, the book's not about Bill Clinton.
Well, I know that.
But
is that part of what goes on in Arkansas that led you to be able to write this with some credibility?
Well, it certainly happens in Arkansas. I think it happens a lot of other places. Mm-hmm. But I think Bill Clinton and Hillary, for some reason, bring out a lot of people who just have to find something on them and believe just the craziest of stories.
Why do you think that is?
I don't know. I think if you were going to be on the East Coast and went to the Ivy League schools, you know, there's a built-in prejudice against the South and Arkansas. But I don't know.
But a lot of this was coming from Arkansas, from people who have lived there, people who are natives.
I know. And I think part of it was he was in the public eye from day one.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he moved back to Arkansas, immediately was running for Congress within a matter of weeks, and has been in the public eye from the very day he came back.
And do you think that rubs people the wrong way, that it's almost wanting too much, too much ambition for one person to have so early in life?
I think that's part of it. I think there were a lot of people who were in line. We had an old line political system going on. We had senior senators, some of the oldest and most senior senators in the U.S. Senate. Wilbur Mills was the congressman from Arkansas, if you remember Wilbur.
I remember Wilbur for things he doesn't want to be remembered for.
Right, absolutely. and then there were people in line who it was their turn. And all of a sudden there's this young man who came back from England and Yale, and all of a sudden took the state by storm.
Mm-hmm. Well, you kind of had your own career path going, because you were the mayor of Little Rock,
right,
at a very young age. How old were you?
I was 29 when I was mayor of Little Rock.
How did that happen?
My story's a little bit different than Bill's. I was on the city council by chance. A friend of mine was on the city board, city council is what it's called in Little Rock. And he said, "We have a vacancy and I want you to apply for it, but you'll never get it." And I said, "Why would I do that?" And he says, "Well, you're a young lawyer. You need to get your name out there."
Right, right.
So I did, and somehow another vacancy occurred, and so I got appointed. And within 6 months, the mayor who was in office said some things he shouldn't have said. And next thing you know, he resigned, and I became the mayor.
Wow.
And in Little Rock, the mayor is kind of like Dan Klotfelter did. The city board itself appoints the mayor.
Oh, okay.
And so among the seven, I was appointed and stayed in that position until 1982.
And you then, later on, went on to become the Chief Justice of the Arkansas Supreme Court. Also, it seems to be an incredibly high position for somebody who was still very young. How old were you then?
I was 34.
34?
Yeah.
I mean, geez. I mean, seriously, how did that happen? I mean, if you have this old line guard, as you do almost probably
right.
in every state in the union,
right.
where people get in line and they pay their dues, and then they're slotted in to have certain positions handed to them or pointed in their direction because they paid their dues, here you come, you're 34 years old, and you're the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court?
That's correct.
What do the other justices feel about that?
They were people I knew. Uh-huh. That's the other part of being Arkansas. It's a small state.
Right.
You know, everybody goes to the University of Arkansas.
Go Razorbacks.
Go Razorbacks. And I was one of them. And then you go back and you spread out across the state. So every member of that court I knew as a friend.
Okay.
And so when I was appointed, they were looking for some leadership. They were having some problems internally, and we were able to fix them.
Wow. So, and of course, Bill Clinton, who was later on the governor of Arkansas, went on to become the president of the United States and took you with him to Washington, D.C., where you ultimately became the associate attorney general, which is the third highest ranking person in the Justice Department in
That's
Washington.
That's correct.
That makes it seems to me all of your incredible accomplishments at such a young age seems to me to make all of this, your story that came later, to be all that much more tragic for you. You're not the first prominent person to fall from grace. You certainly will not be the last. But at some point in the process of all that happening to you, did you ever say to yourself, how in the world did this happen to me?
Of course you did. Of course I did.
What did I do? Where did I go wrong?
Well, I knew. For a long time I was in denial about what I had done. And I knew that once Ken Starr started his quest, that there were going to be people caught up in it. But for a while I was in denial. And then comes the tough time when you have to look yourself in the mirror, deal with it, and go on. And I have.
Was there anything to, in when you come to the final analysis of it, was there anything to the Ken Starr investigation?
I don't think so. You know, he spent over $70 million searching out any and everything about Bill Clinton and Hillary Clinton. I can't tell you how many times I was questioned by the FBI after I pled guilty.
Mm-hmm.
Because if you remember, I was indicted two more times
right.
as they tried to get me to say something about the Clintons.
Are you in denial now?
No, I'm not. I'm not. I wasn't then.
Okay.
I'd gone through the process of learning about myself, paying my dues, and getting out. But
I guess what I'm asking here, when you're talking about the Ken Starr investigation overall, not just into you, but the whole thing that went on for years, are you, because you're so close to the trees, unable to see the forest?
No, I think anybody who looks at it would wonder, what did we spend all that money? Why did we destroy that many lives for?
Was that Ken Starr's doing, or was he just doing his job as the special prosecutor that he was appointed to by, I guess, the Congress appointed him, didn't they? I don't know.
Actually, a three-judge panel appoints him after the Attorney General agrees to withdraw and agrees to have a special counsel.
So was he on a personal witch hunt, or was he just doing his job as appointed?
I think I've never personally thought Ken Starr was an evil person.
Mm-hmm.
I had some issues with his deputies, and I think what was going on, he didn't keep them under wraps. He didn't try to just do his job. He let his deputies go on this, you know, search for something. There's a difference between having a crime and trying to find out who committed it and what was behind it, and looking at a person and trying to find out if they did anything wrong. There's a problem with that.
There were lives, as you say, destroyed by this, and I want to ask you about what this did to your personal life, because obviously you had to rebuild your life and you went to prison for a while. That cannot be an easy thing. But the Clintons came out unscathed.
Yes, they did, and I'm so glad they did.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah, I wish the rest of us had gotten through as unscathed as they did. I think there were a lot of people who were hurt. Certainly a lot of people were hurt financially. Over 100 people in the White House had over $100,000 worth of legal bills after the investigation was over.
Yeah, people don't realize that if you're under investigation, you have to defend yourself, and the White House, the government isn't going to pay for that.
The government doesn't pay for it. Over 100 people had legal bills of over $100,000 after this was over.
Now, you pled guilty to – let me ask you this. You pled guilty to – I've read different accounts of this. It's really confusing – to, I think, federal wire and tax charges.
One count of wire fraud and one count of tax fraud.
Did you do that because you are guilty of that, or did you do that because that would get the gorilla off your back?
I pled guilty because I did it. I had done something wrong, and I needed to accept responsibility for it and move on with my life.
Why did you do what you did?
Why did I do?
Yeah. Because evidently you overbilled, or you were an attorney.
I was an attorney. It involved my billings. And, you know, it's a complicated – I can make it very complicated or very simple. I had a hard time saying no. We had run up some bills, and I fudged on some bills to help pay my credit card.
And there are those who say that members of your firm, of the Rose Law Firm, threw you under the bus because it detracted the attention from them and they put it all on you. Would you say that's true, or would you say that's not true?
I would say that's not true. If I said that, it would mean not taking responsibility for what I did.
And what did you do that had anything to do with the Clintons and the Whitewater investigation?
Absolutely nothing.
Yes.
I was actually on the Supreme Court when that matter initially came up.
On the Supreme Court of Arkansas?
Out of Arkansas, yeah.
So why was that even tangentially related to the case? Why would they indict you or accuse you or make you plead guilty to that? What did it have to do with anything?
It didn't have anything to do with Whitewater. The people who work for Kenstar believed, because a lot of people told them so, that Webb Hubble knows where all the bodies are buried.
Uh-huh.
All you got to do is get him to talk, and he will, the whole thing will bust wide open.
And he was like a dog with a bone.
And for 7 years, they pursued that.
Because you, as you say, were even after you pled guilty, they went after you again and again. It went to the Supreme Court of the United States.
That's right.
And they still went after the Supreme Court said, no, you can't do this.
They indicted me again.
Again?
Yes. Yes. And they told me. They would tell me. They would sit me in the room and say, Webb, if you'll only tell us what we need to know, this whole thing will go away. You can get on with your life.
And you had nothing to say?
I had nothing to say.
Webb Hubble is our guest, former Associate Attorney General of the United States, a lecturer, a consultant, and the author of a new novel called When Men Betray. We're going to talk about that, obviously, as we go through this hour, and we're coming right back. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Blumenthal Performing Arts, presenting the Gershwins' Porgy and Bess now through Sunday. Members of the Broadway cast perform with a 23-piece orchestra in Belk Theater. Tickets available at 704-972-1000. Well, the popularity of yoga is exploding. It's an exercise for the body, the mind, and some say for the soul. There are only a couple of places to practice yoga a few years ago, but now there are, I was going to say dozens, but it's actually more than dozens. And we're going to talk to some local yogis about this phenomenon. They say that yoga is for everyone, not just the affluent, flexible folks, for everybody of all races, all sizes, all shapes, all ages. But just how affordable is it, and who are all these people stretching into strange positions? We will find out tomorrow at 9.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, California's severe drought is in its third year. New reports warn it could cost the state more than $2 billion this year alone. The economic cost of the drought and what it could mean for U.S. food prices.
The Diane Rehm Show, this morning from 10 to noon, after Charlotte Talks, on 90.7 WFAE, Charlotte's NPR news source.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Our guest today is Webb Hubble, whose name you may recognize from the Clinton White House years, but he now lives in Charlotte, and he has written a new novel called When Men Betray. It's his first novel. We were talking prior to the break about the Canstar investigation, which resulted in your being put in jail for 18 months. This strikes me as a devastating experience, whether you're guilty or not, and whether you deserve it or not. It has to be a devastating experience, not just for you as a human being, but as a professional, and for your family and your friends, and a terribly isolating experience. Because once you're under investigation, it would seem to me, in those circles, everybody around you has to abandon you.
Well, the people who are under investigation, the people who are on the periphery of the investigation, all have to walk away. I'm a lawyer. I understand that.
Right.
But at the same time, you have friends who step up. I have a lot of old football teammates. All of a sudden, they were calling. They were writing letters. They were sending me books. You know,
there's some of that in this book, as a matter of fact, because your lead character in this book is an attorney out of Washington,
right,
who is called by a mother of a friend to come and defend her son, who has been not accused of, he shot a United States senator on live television.
On national TV, yes.
Yeah.
Hard to defend.
That's right. There's something you ain't getting out of. And when he walks into this woman's house, all of her true friends have gathered around to support her, but every day he comes back, there are fewer friends.
Right, right. And, it's a shame, mm-hmm. But it's part of the process. It's been a long time ago for me, Mike.
Right.
And I feel like I've moved on.
Is it at all hard to talk about?
It's not hard to talk about now. It was at one time.
Okay.
And, of course, what happened to my family,
right,
it made us stronger.
Is it hard? How do you deal with it within the family? You have children.
Yeah.
And usually daddy and mommy are the heroes of the family, at least to kids. How do you tell kids what has happened?
I counsel people now who are about to go to prison how to deal with these kind of issues. But you've got to be honest with your children. And sometimes it's healthy for your children to know that your parents are fallible, that they make mistakes just like they do. In my case, the hardest thing I ever had to do was sit down with the daughter who's here in Charlotte and tell her that her father, the man she looked up to, had done something wrong and needed to plead guilty, go to prison, and then get on with his life. And she needed to help me do that.
Now, you went to prison for how long? 18 months?
18 months, yes.
Many people believe that people from your echelon, mm-hmm. who are charged and found guilty or plead guilty and go to prison, go to country club prisons where they swim in the pool every day and watch color TV, and it's an air condition, and they have a big library, and you don't have to do anything, and it's like a big, long vacation, a sabbatical is what you call it. Is that what it was like?
No, it was not a country club, that's for sure. I could tell you all kinds of stories, but it's definitely not a country club. There are no swimming pools. There are no golf courses. There are no tennis courts. It's prison, and it's real prison. But at the same time, going to prison is not the end of the world. There are real people there,
but
and you learn that while you're there.
But, you know, you were the head of the Supreme Court in Arkansas.
Right.
You were the third-ranking officer in the Justice Department. You were the guy that would tell the president, do this, don't do that. You're the guy used to giving orders and being in charge. And now in prison, you are not in charge.
No, you're not.
You are the lowest on the totem pole.
Absolutely.
And there are people around you who might want to do you harm, and there are mistakes that you can make to get you in, that will get you in trouble, even though you're completely unaware that this might happen. So how do you deal with this?
Well, you walk on eggshells at first. You learn who your friends are and who your friends aren't in prison. But they're human beings. And I think I made some very good friends there.
Really?
And yes, you're scared. Yes, they'll tell you. The guards will tell you. You may be beat up tonight where you are. But at the same time, you learn, just like you do in any other element of society, how to deal with the situation.
Where did you go to prison?
Went to Cumberland, Maryland. There's a what they call a minimum security facility.
Aha, a country club.
Minimum security does not mean country club. You are still locked up.
What was it like the night before you went?
The night before I went was fine. We gathered together as a family and talked about how we were going to get this behind us and move on. A lot of going to prison is about attitude, and we had developed by that time a very good attitude.
You counsel others who are about to go into this. Did anybody counsel you?
I did. My lawyer got me in touch with somebody who had been in Cumberland, so I had a good idea of what the cells were going to be like, what the facility was going to be like. It's the devil you know mm-hmm. better than the devil you don't know. But it's not a country club.
And how do you get through a year and a half?
I think with the help of friends, with the help of a good family. Like I said, I had a lot of teammates and a lot of friends who wrote me books, wrote me letters. Mm-hmm. I wrote letters back to them. I wrote a book while I was in prison. Mm-hmm. I got healthier. I'd walk the track every afternoon. And I had a good job. I ended up being the cook for 300.
That's a good job.
I could crack a lot of eggs, yes.
But you didn't come back and open a restaurant.
No, I did not. I didn't say it was good cooking. I just said I cooked.
We have an email from Jenny who said, could you ask Mr. Hubbell how he feels about the House of Representatives lawsuit of President Obama? Are there any parallels to what happened in the Clinton years? Is this a cynical ploy by the Republicans, or is this a proper suit?
I don't think it's a proper suit. I think it's there's a lot of frustration in Washington, D.C. on both sides. And it's gotten to the point they don't talk to each other. I think that's a national tragedy, what's going on in Washington. But I don't think a lawsuit is a solution. I'm a lawyer. Mm-hmm. I know what lawsuits do to people. They just make them more defensive. Those people should be in the room drinking a beer and talking to each other.
I've heard that from Congress people who say that the worst thing that's happened is that people in Congress don't spend the weekend in Washington. They have to go home to their districts to campaign and raise money because they're always raising money. And so therefore they can't stay in Washington where they would be forced to mingle with each other and get to know each other and make friendships off the floor.
That's correct.
And that doesn't happen anymore.
It doesn't happen. The moment they're out of Congress, they go next door and they start dialing for dollars.
But it's not just what's happening in Washington. And you kind of – something leapt off the page of your book to me. Your lead character goes back to Little Rock, and his security guy, he wants to go around and see places he remembered as a kid because he hadn't been back in 20 years, 25 years. And he goes back to his high school. And you make a mention of the fact that where the kids used to park their cars – at this high school, there are a bunch of temporary, ramshackle classrooms, and the character makes a comment that we used to take pride in the places where we sent our kids to be educated, and we don't anymore. And that really leapt off the page for me because we've had a lot of conversations on this show about, well, why do you need to spend money on schools? It doesn't matter whether they have an air-conditioned classroom in a nice brick building or whether they have a temporary trailer. Right. As long as the kids are getting an education, what difference does it make? Yesterday was the 45th anniversary of the blast-off of the Apollo 11 mission to the moon, which – you know, we sent these guys into space with no guarantee that they would ever come back, no guarantee that they would actually land on the moon. And yet it was something that we did because it gave us pride.
Felt good about it.
It felt good about it. What happened to all of that?
Well, I don't know. I mean, I'm glad you caught on to that phrase because it's very important to me. We did take pride in our schools. I mean, they were the centerpiece of a community.
Is that the Democrat in you talking?
Or that's not a Democrat. That's Webb Hubble. That's an American. There's the guy who grew up in the South and used to go to great public schools. Mm-hmm. And we cared about them. We wanted our children to go there. We were proud of it. And the buildings were gorgeous. I don't know if you remember those old school buildings. And I hate it when I see a trailer and sticking a kid in a trailer. I think that's society telling our children what we think they're worth, that we're going to just relegate you to a trailer as opposed to one of the best public buildings we can build.
How did we go from the country that won World War II for the Allies and put people on the moon and had grand plans and built an interstate highway system and did all these wonderful things to a country whose infrastructure is crumbling around us, to a country that doesn't want to put money behind certain projects because it's waste? Where did we go wrong? And did we go wrong, or just have we simply shifted our attitude toward other things that are more important to us, like pay no taxes?
I don't think paying no taxes is the solution. I think we used to have much higher tax rates back then, and people were very economically well off. Our middle class was much stronger years ago when we had much higher taxes. You know, but people were proud of their country. They were proud of their community and their state, their schools. We built an interstate highway system that built an economy, and we've got to get back.
And we have reports daily now out of the CDC of mishandling of highly dangerous germs, lackadaisical security with those germs. We have the Veterans Administration doing criminal things. I think they're criminal things, and people ought to be prosecuted and go to jail for this, for what's going on in the VA. That's our government screwing up and not seeming to care about it.
There are a lot of good people in government. I met them. I've worked with them. I think it's a matter of attitude, of leadership. I think what's going on in the VA, as you said, is a tragedy. I wouldn't be sending people to jail. I'd be fixing the system.
Well, if people died because I got my bonus, I ought to go to prison and maybe be executed.
You and I may disagree because I've been to prison. I know what prison's like. But I think we do agree. And that we have to refocus our priorities on our own country, quit trying to be a world leader.
But can we? Because we are.
That doesn't mean we can't shift our priorities back home.
Okay. You live now in Dilworth.
Yes.
I don't want this to sound flippant, but the Washington Post describes Dilworth this way. Big leafy oaks shade the streets in and around this genteel Charlotte neighborhood of historic homes with big porches and an ambiance of understated affluence. But Dilworth is also the home to Paula Broadwell, who is a guest on this program, and Riley Hunter, Rial Hunter, who both of whom have been caught up in scandals of sorts, and now you. And the Post calls Dilworth the Bermuda Triangle of national scandal. What is there about Dilworth?
Well, I love Dilworth. I don't know what the Post was talking about. We live in a very nice place, which Susie and I rent, and are very happy there. The neighbors are very friendly. People ask me, what's the difference between Washington, D.C. and Charlotte? And I said, you go in the bank in the morning, they say, good morning, how can we help you?
Yeah.
You go to the grocery store, and nobody's trying to run you over with their cart. Mm-hmm. You know, you walk down the street, and people say hello and come out of their houses and talk to you.
Is that why you chose to come here?
It's a good reason. I have a daughter who's here, and she has three little they're my granddaughters, her daughters, that are wonderful. I have two other daughters. One also went to Davidson. It's in New Orleans, and although I love to visit, I don't want to live in New Orleans. Mm-hmm. I love coming back to the South, and I love this community. They have welcomed us in so many ways I can't describe.
Getting back to the Washington Post, they brought up an interesting point in an article about you. They said that there are two Webb Hubbles. Do you know about this?
I don't know this.
In one version, you are the Clinton fall guy who went to prison because you wouldn't rat on your friends, the Clintons. In the other, you're the inconvenient friend whose close proximity to the powerful threatened to undermine an entire administration. So which are you in your mind?
You know, all of that is in the past, Mike. Okay. Who I am right now is I'm an author. Mm-hmm. I'm a grandfather and a husband and a father. My priorities, I think, I'm living the best life I can live right now.
Right. How do you rebuild your life after something like this?
It takes some time. You have to. There's an initial shock period when you come out of prison, and in my case, mine was a little longer because I was being indicted time after time.
Yeah.
But once that was over, there's an initial shock period, but you learn through this process what's important.
Because what I'm hearing from you today and what I read about you before you arrived here talks about, and these are from people you know and people who just meet you, that you're optimistic.
I am.
That you are not bitter.
I'm not bitter.
That you are honest about what you did. All of these things are they're demonstrated right here on this program.
Yeah.
How do you get there? From being somebody who falls from the heights, you can't get much higher in politics than the White House.
That's right.
How do you do that? It's not just rebuilding your life financially and rebuilding your relationships when you get out of prison. Mm-hmm. It's rebuilding yourself, your head.
Mm-hmm.
How do you do it?
That's a tough question because I have, but I think what is important, you learn what's important in your life when you go through a tough time. And it's not just going to prison. It may be a health scare. It may be something else. And I've had those too.
Yeah, you've had a liver transplant because of a non-alcoholic-related liver problem.
Yeah, a rare form of hepatitis that came on very suddenly and scared us to death. Mm-hmm. Scared my family more than me. I wasn't aware it was going on. But I think it's all about your attitude. It's all about spending some time with yourself. I meditate every morning, write a meditation that I publish, and try to think about what's really important.
You are a prolific writer. I mean, yes, you wrote a book, a nonfiction book, a couple of years ago. Now you've written this book, When Men Betray, and you've already written the second novel in this series, and you're working on the third.
That's correct.
But you also do these two blog posts. One's political and one is spiritual.
Right. I write a blog post that began about 10 years ago as part of my Lenten discipline. Mm-hmm. I wanted to do something other than give up chocolate chip cookies. And so I started writing a daily blog for 40 days. And then after my transplant, I converted that to write it 5 days a week.
I want to find out what drives you to write and why you have so much to say. We have to take a break, and we'll do that, and we'll talk about this book, When Men Betray, when we come back with Webb Hubble here on Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Hendrick Acura, featuring a new fuel-efficient 2015 Acura TLX sports sedan with a 9-speed automatic transmission. New 2015 models arriving daily. HendrickAcura.com. California supplies a sizable majority of the fruits and vegetables and nuts in the U.S. diet, but the state is suffering through its third year of a devastating drought. Coping with the water scarcity out there could cost California more than $2 billion this year alone, and our prices are about to go up for produce. What the continued drought in California could mean for our food and our wallets, the subject of the conversation in 20 minutes at 10 o'clock on the Diane Rehm Show. And if you'd like to join our conversation with Webb Hubble, now's the time. WFAE.org/Charlotte Talks or Facebook or Twitter will get you to us, and we're coming right back.
Hi, this is Ari Shapiro, and when I'm not reporting from around the world, I sometimes sing with a band called Pink Martini. And if you think your old car has seen better days, try riding around in the back of a band van after 3 weeks on tour. When the time comes to upgrade your ride, donate it to this station. You'll get a tax break, and we'll tow it away for free. Turn your car into the programs you love. Here's how.
Call 1-866-789-8627.
Or go to WFAE.org.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Webb Hubble is our guest, a man I never thought I'd end up talking to, former Associate Attorney General of the United States, a lecturer, a consultant, and the author of several books, one of which has been out for a long time, Friends in High Places, is an autobiography, essentially.
It was written, like I said, the first draft was written when I was in prison.
Mm-hmm.
It came out in 1997. And then this is my first fiction book.
Why fiction?
Well, fiction's a lot easier to write for me. And
why?
Well, because I was a lawyer for 20 years and I wrote fiction every day. The other thing is that people never like what you write about them if it's nonfiction.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you can describe someone as a gorgeous brunette with a brilliant mind, and they'll be offended and say they're blonde. You know, nobody likes to read about themselves as a book. So in writing fiction, you can play with the characters. You can make them what you want them to be.
But, of course, if you write fiction, and you write fiction that takes place in places that you have lived in or worked in, and this book starts in Charlotte,
right,
and goes to Little Rock, two places that you've spent a considerable amount of time in, people are going to wonder, is that me? Is that so-and-so? Who is that person? Mm.
Yeah. In fact, when we went back to Little Rock for the first book signing,
mm-hmm,
most of my friends said, I know you're really writing about me. Of course, I wasn't writing about them at all. They weren't even a thought.
But your experience as a human being, your experience as a lawyer, it must come into play because your lead character is
every fictional book is partially autobiographical.
Mm-hmm.
And certainly this book, I write about places that I know. I might play with them. The barbecue restaurant may not be real, but I've certainly eaten at a lot of barbecue restaurants.
Well, I was going to ask you about Ben's, because Ben's is the barbecue restaurant in Little Rock that your character wants to visit when he's going on his world tour of Little Rock. Is Ben's a real place?
Ben's is not a real place.
Well, why not? Because Mimosa Grill, you write about that. That's a real place in Charlotte.
Ben's is a compilation of all the great barbecue restaurants I've been to in Arkansas. And the character is a compilation of a lot of people I know.
I'm curious as to why, because you talk about going to dinner, having a nice dinner at Mimosa Grill,
right,
and you talk about Davidson because that's where the daughter in the book goes to school,
right?
And you had children who went to Davidson.
Yeah.
So why not pick out a real barbecue place in Little Rock?
Well, that would show favoritism,
okay,
and I've got so many. I didn't want any of them offended and not let me come back.
Well, you know, a courtroom attorney does have to tell a story to the judge.
You tell a story to the judge. You tell a story to the jury. Every brief you write is fiction. And, you're trying to sway someone. So you tend to exaggerate.
That troubles me. Every brief you write is fiction.
It's got a little fiction in it, a little persuasive.
But I thought the law was about truth and justice in the American way. I know that's Superman, but I mean, I thought that was the law too.
Well, the law, you know, I was a judge, and one of the things, and when I went to the Justice Department, one of the things I would do if it was a very tough issue, I would ask both sides to make their most persuasive argument on one side and make the most persuasive argument on the other side, and somewhere in the middle, I could find the truth and the right decision. I think that's a good way to look at a lot of things. I think I wish Congress would do a little more of that. Make your position and then try to find the truth in the middle.
So there's no absolute truth?
There's a few absolute truths, but in the law, there's not a lot of absolute truths in the law, and you know that.
Well, and I think people, if they thought about it, would realize that everybody has their own perception of the truth because we all experience the world individually.
Right. Absolutely. Absolutely.
Your protagonist, Jack Patterson, is a D.C. antitrust lawyer,
right,
who comes back to Little Rock to help an old friend who has shot and killed a U.S. senator in the Arkansas Capitol Rotunda on live national television. That happens on the third page of your book. What a way to get started.
I wanted to get everybody's attention.
Well, you sure did. Where did the idea for that come from?
Actually, the book started, I wanted to tell a story about four boys growing up and then coming back 25 years later. That was the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
I knew I had to grab somebody's attention, and I couldn't think of a better way than, you know, a murder on the state capitol.
So Jack Patterson is one of the four boys. The man who commits the murder is the second of the four
Woody
boys.
Woody Cole, yes.
Then there's the prosecutor,
right,
who's the third of the four boys. And the fourth is whom?
It's the judge.
It's a small state.
Marshall. You know, and I've heard from several people in North Carolina say that wouldn't happen here.
Right.
Well, I know it does happen in Arkansas, and I'd be surprised that as many people, you know, that it couldn't happen.
Because there, the judge, I mean, the prosecutor does not recuse himself, even though he has had a lifelong personal relationship with the accused.
Right. They had had a falling out, and we talk about that in the book, about the recusal issue, whether he should or shouldn't, but he doesn't.
Would that be legal, really, in Arkansas?
Oh, yes. It's been known to happen. I'd be surprised if it hadn't happened in North Carolina.
But why isn't it illegal? That's
It's a matter of personal judgment on the behalf of the elected official. A recusal. The same with judges. And when you live in a state where you know people, I know of a circumstance where the prosecutor and a murderer who was ultimately convicted went to high school together. It's not that rare.
You know, there are several crimes that have been committed over the course of time that people say, well, why waste time on the trial? We know he did it. We saw him do it. He did it. He's guilty. Done. This guy kills a senator that he's working for on live television. He did it.
Right.
So where do you go from there?
Well, I created a scenario where Jack first wants to know why.
Right.
And his friend won't help him. He says, I'm not going to help you. I just want to die. And so I think...
And that was his intent in the first place, wasn't it?
Yes.
He didn't intend to kill the senator.
Well, I'm going to have you read the book.
Okay, well, yes.
I'm not going to give it away.
All right. When Jack Patterson, your D.C. antitrust lawyer, is first drawn into the case, he's contacted by his firm because of an emergency. It's a Friday evening, and he muses that, and this is a quote from the book, the Justice Department loves to indict a high-profile client late on a Friday afternoon. With no one available to set bail or to do the paperwork to get the accused out of jail, the poor guy has to cool his heels in a holding tank or worse, leaving the press the whole weekend to repeat the prosecution's side of the story. That's a kind of an indictment of the Department of Justice that you used to head up.
That's right.
It is. And the media. Which is the worst offender here, the DOJ or the media?
I have lots of friends who are prosecutors and lots of friends who are the media. But on the other hand, I've seen this happen time and time again. And it's a ploy. It's to try to get an edge. Just like some people try to get an edge in a baseball game or a football game.
And it kind of goes against what I've always heard. I've always heard that the White House or government entities who want to bury bad news will release it late on a Friday afternoon,
right,
because nobody's watching the news on Saturday or Sunday. It'll blow over by Monday. And maybe that's not true in the 24-hour news cycle, but that's the way it used to be. What you're saying, though, is that with the Department of Justice, they'll announce it on a Friday afternoon and let the guy just blow in the wind for the weekend.
He doesn't have a lawyer. He doesn't have anybody to respond. He's sitting in jail or worse.
Is that fair?
No, it's not fair. I hope that comes
across.
Justice
supposed to be fair?
Justice is supposed to be blind, yes. But I don't think there's anybody listening who believes that justice is completely fair or completely blind.
You also paint the media, because this is a small town, Little Rock. It's, you know, it's a state capital, but it's everybody knows everybody. And the television media, when somebody commits a murder on live television in your town, it's going to be the only story.
Right.
And it becomes the only story. And everywhere you go, everywhere Jack Patterson, the attorney, goes, there are TV people there. And they are intrusive, and they are beaten down the door, try to get the story, and he watches himself on television being portrayed inaccurately.
Right.
Does that come from your personal experience?
There's a little bit of personal experience in that part of the book. Yes,
I know you have a new attitude and you've adjusted yourself to life after the Attorney General's office, but I mean, is this your way of getting back?
I don't have a get back in me, but I enjoyed writing those parts.
And it's true.
It is true. It is true.
But are they being unfair when the media? Because the media doesn't know everything. I mean, as a matter of fact, the media reporters don't know anything. That's what they are there to find out.
Yeah.
And in a live situation where the story is unfolding and developing, they don't have the luxury of going back and spending 18 hours writing and editing and recrafting and checking all the sources and then putting it out.
Right.
It's live. So that does put them in a predicament.
They're in a dilemma, and usually it's partially created by the lawyers. The prosecutors are willing to have press conferences and talk about their case and release the indictment and give the press their story. They're trying to make this person seem and appear guilty before he ever appears in a courtroom. At the same time, most defense lawyers, very good defense lawyers, in my case and in other cases, will tell the defense, we don't talk. We do our talking only in the courtroom. And that, from a client standpoint, that's very frustrating. And from the media standpoint, their only source is one side.
So when the media is portrayed as being one-sided, it's not their fault.
To some extent, it's not their fault. I think they have a responsibility to try to dig out a little bit.
But you're not talking.
Well, I'm not talking, but other people do. Yeah.
But in the book, for instance, you go in, as the Jack Patterson goes in, and tells the people who are helping the defendant's mother to talk to no one, say nothing.
Right.
Don't let anybody in.
I've seen it done many a time.
Even if they just want to use the bathroom, they'll never leave. They're just there to get the story. Don't let them in. You're telling nobody to talk to anybody. So if that's the case, all the information's coming from the prosecutor.
That's reality, even though it is fiction. The book is fiction. But the reality is it's based on my experience and the experience of many people I counsel and talk to. Mm. It's usually the defense keeps quiet. And the press's only source is the prosecution.
The other thing that I found troubling is that the first time the attorney, Jack Patterson, goes to meet with his old friend Cole, who he, at this point in the book, intends not to represent. He's just there on a fact-finding mission, and he will get him a good lawyer because he's not a criminal defense attorney.
Right.
He's an antitrust lawyer. But he goes to meet him in the jail, and he gets a nanosecond with the guy in a room with paper-thin walls that he knows guards and perhaps the prosecutor can hear the conversation going on in the room, and he's only given a couple of seconds in the room with the guy. Does that really happen?
Yes.
I mean, it's supposed to be attorney-client privilege. How can you have that when everybody can hear what's being said?
Yes, it does. Think of the concept of a person in prison who's supposed to be having a confidential conversation with his lawyer. It's being recorded by the by the prison people and can be listened to by the prosecutor.
Well, how is that fair?
I didn't say it was fair.
Well, how is that allowed?
It is allowed.
Well, why? What happened to attorney-client privilege? Can they use that? Is that privileged information? Can they use what they overhear?
I'm sure they do.
This is America. This flies in the face of what we've been taught about American justice.
Well, I mean,
how is this different from Iranian justice?
This is America. We listen into everybody's phone conversations now, so don't get me off on that point. On my book.
No, actually, I think I will get you off on that point. You used to be with the Department of Justice, and I know that's separate from the NSA, but still, we are listening in on everybody's conversations. We're listening in on foreign leaders that we agree with's conversations.
Right.
We are reading emails, etc. How much of this is legal?
I don't think a lot of it is legal, but we are doing it, and it's very, very troubling. I've written about it, as you know, in my political blog.
And it's worse today. Yes, and it's worse today, I'm told, under President Obama than it was under President Bush. Is that because we've gotten better at it or because we believe in it more?
I think we've grown to accept that in the name of national, quote, national security, everything's permitted. And that's very, very troubling.
Have we overreacted?
Yes.
To 9/11.
I think not to 9/11,
okay.
But I think we've overreacted to our fears.
But what's the alternative?
It's not be so, pardon my French, afraid.
Well, we are. I think we've gone from being this courageous, strutting world power that sends people to the moon to people cowering in a corner.
You know, one of the things they say about terrorism is they win when they get you to change your lifestyle
Have they won?
They're winning.
Charlotte's last elected mayor, Patrick Cannon, resigned after being charged, though not yet indicted, by the Justice Department, which seems odd to me. It's been a long time now. He's living through something like what you went through. What would you say to him, or have you talked to him?
I have not talked to the mayor. I would, of course, because I counsel people all the time.
What would you say to him and his family?
You'll get past this. You'll get through it. You'll have a life afterwards. I would counsel him to get it behind him as quickly as he could.
Meanwhile, Hillary Clinton is also on a book tour.
Yes, she is.
And her book makes it appear as though she might be running for the office with no walls, no corners.
I read that yesterday.
As John Stewart says. If she is on the ballot, would you vote for her?
Yes.
Why?
The Hillary I knew, and I haven't talked to her recently.
Very quickly.
Was a huge advocate of education, the importance of education. And I'd like to see that get on the front burner of this country.
I'm only halfway through your book, When Men Betray, but I can tell you it is a page-turner, and I can't wait to find out how it turns out. Webb Hubble's book, When Men Betray, a thriller, a tour de force by some in some counts. Thank you for the hour.
Thank you for having me.
Charlotte talks with Mike.